Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the state has replaced the Adult Day Health Care Program with a new plan designed to save the state money. But advocates of the elderly and disabled say it is leaving many of the state's most vulnerable out in the cold. And the Valley's bad air, is it getting worse instead of better? And what role does climate change play in the Valley's air quality? Plus, summer fun at the Fossil Discovery Center. But first, adult day health care in California is feeling the pinch of the state's budget crisis. The state has been working to scale back the publicly funded program that helps elderly and fragile adults. Meanwhile, centers are struggling to keep their services going. Pauline Bartolone visited one center in Sacramento that serves as a community space for Eastern European immigrants.
Every weekday at Altamedics Adult Day Healthcare Center in North Sacramento, over 100 Russian-speaking immigrants follow a tight schedule of health education and exercise.
It's very structured here.
Michael Borisov is the lead social worker at Altamedics. He says the people here get this state-funded service because their health is at risk. Almost all of them are elderly.
They need at least supervision with things like bathing, dressing. They are unable to access resources by themselves without assistance.
Some of the Eastern Europeans here came as refugees after the fall of the Soviet Union. Their medication is managed and their therapy individualized. But Borisov says that's not all they get.
For many of them, this is everything. This is the only contact with the outside world that they get.
When a legal settlement restored adult day health in the state budget last year, the new program was reserved only for the frailest. In recent months, state-employed nurses have been visiting the centers to determine which participants are needy enough to keep getting the service.
It's difficult, but it's better than the worst-case scenario.
Sergei Ionov is Altamedics' director. He says 28 participants have been deemed ineligible for service. They appealed and hope to win back the right to stay. The center isn't being paid while they wait for the appeal hearings.
A lot of these people have attended our program for years, and they need the services. They have little or no alternatives.
The state is also backlogged on paperwork that allows Altamedics to be paid for other participants. Ionov says more than 40% of the cases here are currently unbillable, and he keeps the doors open with a line of credit.
The main thing is that our participants continue reserving services. That's the main thing.
At over 260 centers like this around the state, the cash flow situation is what Lydia Messalides would call dire. She's with the California Association of Adult Day Services, or CADS.
Some centers have already reduced hours of operation. Some have already reduced their staff, laid off some staff. Some are preparing plans for temporarily closing. Others are having a very difficult time finding lines of credit.
CAD surveyed its centers. Those that responded said if the state reimbursements don't start coming in soon, they would have to close, lay off staff, or stop serving the participants who have been judged ineligible.
It's the worst I've seen in all of my years of working in this field. And I'm trying to stay optimistic.
The California Department of Healthcare Services says about 1,800 people have been found ineligible and have asked for an appeal. And about 200 nurses are working on the entire transition. John Chen is the state's director of long-term care.
So we're behind and we'll try to catch up, okay, just because of the volume of the work that we have to deal with.
Shen says they're hoping the hearings will go more quickly when they've ironed out the system.
This has been a long, hard process for the department as well as for the provider as well as for the consumer, not knowing what happened to them. But we are really at the end of the, so to speak, at the end of the tunnel.
But for many participants, hearings could be months away. And for the centers, the transition is far from over. Meantime, Altimatics continues to serve the 28 ineligibles without reimbursement. The old and fragile adults are known to break out in traditional church songs during monotonous exercise. They may not fully understand the complexity of the situation, but they fear they may not be coming here for much longer. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
There is much more to discuss with this issue, and joining us now are Lydia Misselides, who you heard in the report. She is the executive director for the California Association for Adult Day Services, and Anu Mohan, a program director at Chateau de Bakersfield, an adult day program in Bakersfield. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just listening to the report, I think the first thing that sort of strikes me before we go back over this is that they mentioned that about 1,800 people have been found ineligible, so they're having hearings to see if they can stay in the programs. What happens with those folks in the meantime while they're waiting on these hearings?
Well, I know I was hearing another Adult Day Healthcare Center who said that they were continuing to serve the clients. But in our case, we have decided to not serve the client because our program is not that big. We don't serve a big population. So if you were to look at 14 clients, which was denied under our center, that is a huge amount of financial burden that our center will not be able to take. We had to lay off 4 staff and cut the hours of some of our staffing right now. So I don't know how the other center is doing and continuing to serve this because it could take up to a year. And the people that we were serving, those 14 clients, we also did not get reimbursed. We've been serving them since February, and we didn't even find out that they were denied until, like, June.
And this is Anu?
Yes, this is Anu.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Anu, you're talking about your program in Bakersfield.
That's correct.
And what's happened there?
Well, we had almost 14 clients denied, and we currently serve about 50 clients a day, so that would put us at a huge number of clients that were not eligible to be coming to our program. So once the clients were denied, our board decided that we couldn't continue to serve them until the appeal process actually confirms that they were eligible.
Now, Ms. Misselides, this whole program, the adult daycare program. Now, it was dropped altogether, and this new program, I think, as a result of a lawsuit, was sort of like a compromise between the two. So the state had originally planned just to drop the whole program. Was that not the case?
That is correct, and it was a shock to everyone in our field and anyone who works with the frail elders around California and actually around the nation when this decision was made. And it was quite traumatic for the families, the participants, the staff, people like Anu and her personnel to begin preparations that started actually last summer about this time to close down 330-some centers around the state, some of which had been in operation for 25, 30 years and were part of the fabric of their community.
Why was adult daycare targeted in the first place?
Well, I've been asking myself that question for the last 2 years, and I don't have a good answer. I have been working in this field directly for 25 years, and I never dreamed that any policymaker would have the courage to eliminate a program that served the most vulnerable, the most ill, the most frail in our communities. And particularly as we look at the Central Valley, your community, your listenership, the impact of even losing one or two centers, and we have had closures, Juanita, is devastating for the community. And we have many stories that we have now heard of people who have been removed from closed centers and have ended up directly in state-funded institutions.
Now, the whole I think from what I've read, the idea was the reason they were tightening up the eligibility requirements was to reduce fraud and cost in Medi-Cal. And the state was just supposed to save money. But if these people are being placed in state-run nursing homes, which cost more than the adult day programs, then they've kind of defeated the purpose.
Absolutely.
That's absolutely correct.
The type of services that adult day health care, or now currently called CVAS, is nowhere else to be found. This is the only program that is so comprehensive. We provide occupational therapy, physical therapy, RN nursing services, medication monitoring, psych. We serve a high population of psych, Kern County mental health clients, and developmentally disabled. We serve autistics population. So there's just no other program like this. So I talk to Lydia about this all the time, and I tell her I don't understand how can a program that's only costing $76, including transportation, food, meals, that they would even think about eliminating. So I don't even know where the cost saving is. It doesn't even make sense. So many of my clients who are psych go in and out of crisis unit because they don't have any other place to go, because they don't have the services that are available. They constantly kept getting denied their services, and I have to keep fighting for them every single time.
You know, to our listeners out there, and many of you may be impacted, you may have elderly parents. A lot of times with this, the previous program, many of the caregivers were family members. So we would really like to hear from you. If you could give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989, or you can email us at talk@kbpr.org and let us know how you are dealing with this situation. And also the fact that when we look at our state's budget and how we try to balance it, a lot of times it seems programs are targeted that really isn't saving the state a lot of money, and the really big ticket items are sort of ignored.
Well, I think that's true. This is Lydia, and this is a population, let's face it, it doesn't have a voice. These are people who have difficulty even leaving their homes. So it is unfortunate to think in these terms, but I think that is part of the calculation or equation. I think also that this is a population that is relatively hidden from sight. Mm-hmm. Many people who look like your or my parents or grandparents who are in ill health. But these are also people who are living in poverty. As you heard from Pauline Bartoloni's story, some people who have come here as immigrants who have been terribly traumatized in their life situation, and people who don't really have a voice, a political voice.
So what would be any kind of alternative? You've talked about the fact that the state is now holding hearings to see if some of those who have been deemed ineligible are indeed eligible to be put back in the programs. And as you heard in the report, the person with the state is, you know, saying, well, yes, we'll get to it when we can. But what happens, as I mentioned before, what happens to these people in the meantime? And are families having to change or, let's say, quit work or do whatever it is they have to do to try to now take care of their elderly relatives?
Well, the thing is, when they become ineligible for our services, the sad part is that there is no other services that are out there. So they literally don't have any other services. So you're correct. Sometimes the family does have to find, you know, juggle the parents between sisters or brothers or whatever they can do, and they keep calling us, you know, what is the next plan? So they are struggling a lot. And you know, when somebody's working, when somebody becomes ineligible, it doesn't just affect that person. It affects the entire family. So you're affecting somebody's family's whole well-being. Somebody will have to quit. Somebody will have, now they're losing their income. Now, you know, state is also losing that the unemployment rate is going on. So it's turning back and costing the state even more, because now they have to pay unemployment to that person, and now the person is not paying, is unable to pay taxes. So it's a bigger impact than what it appears initially.
And these programs are created in a way to not only provide the services, but the caregivers some free time so they could go to work during the day.
And absolutely.
And their loved one would be taken care of.
Absolutely. And, you know, the only choice they have is to go into now skilled nursing or convalescent hospital, because there is nothing else out there that they can send. So there's no solution. So they're eliminating these services. They're making them ineligible without any other option for the family. So that's the question we keep asking. Well, give them in-home support services. But the in-home support services hours are being cut left and right. They don't approve clients that easily. So the cuts are everywhere across the board. So we are still trying to figure this out. What is the solution for this?
And if they do go into state-run nursing homes or who pays for that? Now, will they be eligible for Medi-Cal if they do that at that point, whereas the state is saying to go into these community day centers, they wouldn't be eligible, but they would be eligible then if they were to go into a state nursing facility?
I believe so. I can't be sure. I don't know how it's going to look like under managed care, but even that, from what I read, that people who are going into skilled nursing, it's a mess. The eligibility criteria is even very strict. There's not enough beds, so there's a huge waiting list on those. So it doesn't just end there. It's layers and layers of issues that needs to be resolved.
Now, we know here locally that St. Agnes did have an adult day health center. They closed that last year in anticipation of what was going to happen and the fact that they just could not afford it anymore.
And we were very close to that. Lydia knows that. We were very close to closing down, too. We stopped taking clients. Our number dropped so small that we couldn't even financially afford to keep it open. And we did at one time close down for almost three and a half weeks.
And here in Fresno County, over 1,000 people depended on that. But the majority of them, from what I read, 951 were low income. So they relied on state-funded insurance. They relied on Medi-Cal. So those people should be in one of these programs. But with the rate that they're being impacted because of funding, a lot of them won't have a place to go.
That's correct.
And Juanita, Elder Life, Adult Day Health Care in Bakersfield just shut their doors recently. So another center has closed. We've lost quite a bit of capacity in the Central Valley already. And once that capacity goes, it's gone, mm-hmm. because the state is not approving any new centers to open.
If you end up one by one having the facilities that are currently there close, will the state even have enough facilities for them?
Well, that's a question that Disability Rights California, I believe, is asking the state and the federal government, because the legal settlement does talk about access to care and preserving access, and that has not been well defined yet, but I can just tell you from where I sit and from how I am observing the situation here from Sacramento, that we are losing capacity rapidly. We've lost 36 centers to closures just since January of last year. So that's a rate of 3 centers per month closing. And if that rate is continued, there will be an incredible loss of access across the state. And I am particularly concerned about the Central Valley because of what Anu's describing. Very few alternative resources exist.
No, there's already a problem, and I think from what I've read is that the state is really the state's plan is relying on counties and managed care insurance companies to provide the services. Well, we know in Fresno County that our county is does not have the money. The budget is strapped. There are already problems that the county is dealing with because of tight funds. And I would say many other counties are dealing with the same situation because they've all had to deal with the same kind of economic climate. So if the state plan is relying on the counties and the counties are already financially strapped, that really is not an alternative.
Well, I'd like to address that. Nhu has been meeting with her managed care organizations, and we've been actually doing that around the state because the next step in this transition, as difficult as it has been to date, is going to get even more difficult because of what you just described, Juanita, and that is the adult day health care, CBAS, community-based adult services benefit, will only be available through managed care in your counties beginning October 1st. So in Fresno, for example, you are correct. The county operates a health insurance program, and there's a private insurer as well. And the only way that a patient will be able to get a CBAS is by enrolling in a Medi-Cal managed care plan. Mm-hmm. So there is a tremendous amount of risk involved, both because there's so much confusion among the patients and their families about what this all means, because oftentimes they have Medicare insurance as well as Medi-Cal.
Because they're elderly.
Because they're elderly, right. 80% of our patients around the state are what are called duals. You'll start hearing that term more, dual eligible. In other words, they do have Medicare and Medi-Cal. So there's a lot of confusion about what this means, how to do it. Does it mean I lose my Medicare benefit? The answer is no, but a tremendous amount of confusion. And you layer on top of that, you know, language barriers and poor communication from the state to the consumer. It's a mix for a lot of difficulty ahead in the next few months. So that's our next major challenge on top of everything that's going now with cash flow and hearings and appeals.
And Anu, you had something to say?
Yeah, I was just going to piggyback on what Lydia said, that the confusion is really extreme. And the clients that we serve, we have been having constant communication with them about managed care, but the deadline of transfer. I always think about the people who are not attending some of these programs. I don't even think most of them know that the switch is happening, because a lot of our clients, their family had no idea, and the state has been saying that they've been sending letters, they have been telling them. I don't know where these letters are going. I don't know how they're being informed. I can tell you that we were the only resource that had informed our clients, worked with them to make sure that they had a proper transition to managed care. So if that was the case with our center, I bet there are thousands of adults that don't even know what's going to happen in October.
Now, Ms. Missoulides, you are with the State Association for Adult Day Services, or California Association, so it's a statewide association. And you said you are hearing this up and down the state from these facilities and the fact that many of them have had to close. Do they have a next step? Do they have, okay, what do we do next?
For the centers who are remaining open, are you asking?
Yes.
Juanita? Well, we are collectively going to be discussing what we believe some solutions might be, short-term as well as some longer-term solutions, with the state next week. And I believe disability rights is in ongoing discussions. They are the public interest law firm that did file the lawsuit and ended up settling with the state. And we have some ideas about trying to facilitate, expedite some of the eligibility decisions. The hearings right now, were they to be just scheduled in a humanly possible manner, are going to go at least through December. And state law requires hearings to be held within 90 days. So there's already a tremendous backlog of authorizations, a tremendous backlog of hearings. Challenge right now is just helping centers keep their doors open.
Is part of that, when you take a look at the backlog and there seems to be a lack of preparation, do you think the state prepared for this? Or, as we mentioned earlier, the original goal was just to cut the program altogether. So do you think the state was prepared to try to do this compromise?
I think that the time frame provided for this transition was extremely tight, and it was projected even to be quicker than what it ended up to be. There have been several extensions of timelines. For example, the transition to managed care was supposed to begin July 1. It's now been extended to October 1, with the exception of a few counties. None of them are in your Central Valley area. So it has been too fast. Bureaucracies, by their nature, are not able to move quickly. And it is amazing that so much has been done in such a short time, and we have 80% people found eligible initially, and that's the good news to report. But we are very worried about mistakes that have been made, errors in human judgment that have been made so far, and could get worse as new people come into the program.
And that's something, too, that you have to consider, that this doesn't stop because the program has changed or goes away. You still have elderly and disabled people who end up needing these services. This is happening daily when somebody finds out that they have a situation that's going to place them where they have to have this kind of medical care.
Absolutely. And Anu can attest that often people come to us, referrals come from the county, from families, from doctors, from any source in the community, but often they come when someone is in a crisis point.
That's correct.
And so it becomes even more incredibly important to get somebody into service quickly. And the processes that have been set up now to make someone eligible or find them ineligible are taking a very long time. So how long can you expect a provider to provide free care?
Anu, you were saying, she talked about how this is impacting you and that new people are coming daily. Have you had to, because you've said you've already had to cut, so I assume you're having to turn people away.
Yes. The 14 people that became ineligible, they were the clients that I had forwarded two of those people to Lydia and other people. One of the clients was severe in a crisis unit, in and out of the hospital multiple times, and these programs stabilizes them so much, and I have seen it so many times. And she was referred to us, and she came into our program, stayed with us for 3 months. She was stable, and then they made her ineligible, and I had to discontinue her services because, like I said, programs such as ours is not able to continue to provide services without the reimbursement. We count on those funds to serve all of our clients. So if those funds get cut, then you have to make the ship not sink. So 14 of the clients I had to discharge, all of them. I could not continue to provide services for them. And I had to, and I found out almost 4 months later that they were being ineligible.
I know that you have the program in Bakersfield. How many other programs like that are there in Bakersfield?
We are the only one.
Remember, the only one.
The Elder Life was another one that closed down, so we're basically the only one. So we are not taking any new clients at this time. Until this is all sorted out, because the ratio of denial is so high that we're going to be taking a huge chance. You know, like I said, 100% of the new clients were denied, so that's too high for us.
The people who are being denied, are you hearing from relatives at all as far as what is happening to them?
Absolutely. I just got a call, actually, from one of the clients' wife, and she called. She said, you know, since my husband has really declined, is it possible that I can get him in the private pay? I'm willing to pay for this, at least that he can come 2 days. I said, so I talked to her. I said, I have filed an appeal, so, if just so you can get him out, I agreed to let him come 2 days a week. But what happened was when our driver went out to go get the client, he was so decomped that she couldn't even get him out of bed. She may be one person you may want to talk to. He's decomped so much in such a short time because he was attending Elder Life for a while, so he was being transferred to us, and he became ineligible. So I was going to take him as a private pay, but she wasn't even able to get him out of bed.
Lydia, Mr. Lides, and Anna Mujan, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Let's see what the next step is. We'd like to do some follow-up once you meet with state officials to see if there are any alternative, because I'm sure there's so many people who have relatives who are just waiting to see how this is going to turn out. And we thank you both for coming this morning and sharing more on this. Again, Lydia Missolides, Executive Director of the California Association for Adult Day Services, and a new MOHAN Program Director, Chateau de Bakersfield. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Last month, on the weekend, Fresno was hosting the CIF State Track and Field Championship. The Valley was experiencing the worst air in the nation. We had the worst air in the nation that day. Clean air advocates criticized the Valley Air District, saying it wasn't doing enough to alert residents about the dangerous air quality. Officials said with the air districts that their equipment was broke that day. Now, this comes at a time when a group of scientists say pollution will only get worse here in the Valley due to climate change. Our guests today to discuss this are Kevin Hall, Central Valley Air Quality Coalition, with the Central Valley Air Quality Coalition, and Don Anair, Senior Vehicles Analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists, who just did this study, and we're going to talk about that a little bit, too. So last month, we had really several really bad air days. And in the past, there would have always been a warning. You know, I remember those. And so I think a lot of people were surprised that they even went ahead that day with the track meet when we had that bad air day.
Well, that was the first incident, Juanita, of a really unusual confluence of a major outdoor athletic event and some serious air pollution issues. We actually not only had such a bad air day on that day, although I have to say that ozone and formation of ozone is an inexact science, so that it's almost like a cloud that moves around. And on that particular day, at the time the kids were running, the ozone levels there did not reach the very highest levels we saw. Parlier that day happened to be the worst place to have been. Last week, however, it was a far different story in the San Joaquin Valley, where we had violations of the federal air standard at every of the 24 air pollution monitors throughout the San Joaquin Valley from north to south. And in fact, every day that week, ending on Friday the 13th, you'll see that we had multiple violations at every station throughout the San Joaquin Valley. And we had very high levels throughout central Fresno, Clovis, Madera, Parlier.
Doesn't that make it worse for our situation when we were in violation of those days? It's making it difficult for us, number one, to comply with what the new regulations are.
Well, it's making it difficult to breathe, of course, right?
That too.
And ozone is essentially scarring one's lungs. It's millions of microscopic tears, and then those scar over and reduce lung function. Among a host of other conditions. The compliance issue is really being hyped by the Air District in an inappropriate way. And what I mean by that is one of our major concerns right now is their failure to not only issue public health alerts, but the ones that they do at a reasonable level, they wait until air pollution levels reach exceedingly high levels, well up into the purple on the air quality color-coded index. And we're entering danger zones much lower than the levels at which they call those emergency air alerts. But even on July 9th and last week, and even on June 1st when we saw the first such violation, they did not issue even their own emergency air alerts. The compliance issue is about the one-hour standard, which we were supposed to have achieved in 1999. And we're paying $29 million
exactly.
in sanctions,
it's
right?
Costed.
It is, but there's a more important standard that we're far, far greater distance from achieving, and that's the 8-hour ozone standard. And that's the one where if the district was really protecting people's health, we would have had 30 or 40 air alerts. You were referring to what was known as spare the air days.
Yeah. Well, they don't do that anymore.
They threw it out a few years ago. They decided to go with a more public relations-oriented healthy air living program, which on its own would be just fine. But we need both. We need to let people know when the air is reaching dangerous levels.
You know, is this in a way because, you know, here in the Valley, we have struggled with bad air for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think we've gotten to a point that maybe some people, maybe some citizens, we've become sort of complacent because we have lived with it for so long? Because on extremely bad air days, you can still go out and see people participating in sports, doing everything that even the Valley Air Districts recommend that you don't do on a day like that.
I don't know that it's complacency, perhaps in some instances. I think a lot of it is lack of information. And I think that this is, you're highlighting one of the real problems with the Valley Air Board's strategy of not warning people, that instead people, for example, you might recall there was a lot of to-do made September 1st last year about the fact that we came through August without a violation of the one-hour ozone standard, again, that very old standard. And the headline across the local paper was ozone violation-free August or something. It was ridiculous. It's very misleading, this campaign. I'll give you a better example of public health warnings. In this spring and early summer, you did see warnings about high winds are creating dusty conditions, and that the Air District did do. They need to be doing that as well for ozone pollution levels, smog levels in the summer months at a level that is reflective of when damage is done.
I'd like to bring in Mr. Anair now with the Union of Concerned Scientists, because you all just, the study is a couple of years old, but you completed this study looking at how climate or temperature impacts the air quality. And that climate change, it will only make our situation worse here in the Valley when it comes to pollution.
Yeah, that's right. We did this report last year, but I think talking about it now makes a lot of sense given the ozone challenges that happen around the country during the summer months, including obviously in the Central Valley. The report really looked at what the potential impacts would be on ozone formation from the increased temperatures expected with climate change over the next 10 and 40 years, so looking at 2020 and 2050. And really what was found was that there would be, if emissions stayed the way they are today, there would be an increase in ground-level ozone pollution, and with that would come greater health impacts, including respiratory symptoms, emergency room visits. And those could add up, in California alone, those could add up to more than $700 million a year just in the health costs, not including pain and suffering and other impacts.
Could you explain for us what ground-level ozone pollution is?
Sure. It's really, it's what is commonly referred to as smog, and it's a combination of the emissions of vehicles and power plants, of nitrogen oxide emissions, and volatile organic gases react in the presence of sunlight. And so with higher temperatures, that reaction occurs more readily and creates this ground-level ozone, which is a pollutant, as Kevin had explained, really damages the tissues in the lungs. And so it's dangerous to breathe and can cause or exacerbate symptoms of asthma, respiratory disease. And children and the elderly are the most impacted by these exposure to this pollutant.
And Juanita, just to add to one source that Don is familiar with but didn't mention, of course, is that we have this huge dairy and feedlot industry, beef feedlots, and they are the largest or amongst the largest sources of volatile organic compounds in the Valley, too. So in
That's
addition
right.
to those sources.
So we have a lot to deal with, not only when we look at climate, but just because of the nature of where we live in this region. Our pollution has always been impacted by the fact that we are an ag community, and it gets very hot here. Now, one of the things that we talk about how weather is impacting pollution, and, you know, just before I came in this morning, I was listening to one of the news programs, and they were talking about the extreme heat this summer, and it's a different part of the country, but it's the east, and it was the fact that the other part was 80% of the country was experiencing abnormally dry weather, which also is a factor, and that this summer we have experienced extreme heat on the East Coast. And one of the meteorologists was saying this is the driest time in this country since the 1930s. So all of this comes together when you look at it. When you hear things like that, and, you know, the kind of weather I'm talking about, it goes from one section of the country to the other. You know, 1 year it may be the West Coast who experiences weather like this. This year is on the East Coast. But still, when we have weather like this and we have climate changes like this, this going on in our climate, how does that impact our air?
Well, you know, I think in California, at least, extreme weather events, especially including days when you're getting extreme temperature changes, or more, you're going to see more frequency of that type of increased temperatures, and that's going to lead to more days that are very conducive to ozone formation. So that will mean dealing with additional days where the air quality is unhealthy. You know, I want to point out too that, you know, the air quality has been improving, but the science has also been improving as well in terms of the health impacts of exposure to air pollution. And so that's why over the years the standards for what constitutes healthy air have gotten tighter. And that means we have to do more and more to reduce those emissions. What the climate impact will be is that it is likely to be harder to meet those healthy air standards because of the frequency and occurrence of more days that are conducive to ozone formation.
And we do want to say that with the Valley Air District, we have seen some improvement in the quality of our air when you look at it over the last, you know, 10, 20 years. So we do have to acknowledge that. But as you stated, because of different changes, we're dealing with situations that make it even worse.
Potentially, yes. The another factor, of course, is that as a result of climate change, spring is a week earlier and fall is a week later, so we have a longer, hotter season. One of the other important factors around ozone formation in the valley is wind. We're actually having a fairly moderate summer in terms of temperature so far, and we have had a few really stagnant episodes combining high heat and low winds. That usually goes together. And in ozone formation, there's even a phenomenon in the valley that is theoretical, but it seems to hold true, is that sometimes we hit a high enough temperature that it actually pierces the lid that sits down on top of us, and the ozone levels don't get as high as they might have otherwise. That's not what we saw last week, however.
But when we take a look at this, I know, Kevin, your concern and the organization you're with, your concern is really working with the public to help them understand our air quality and the kind of precautions people should take. And they should be made more aware of when we have these incidents of spikes in our and bad air.
That's true, Juanita. That's one issue that we're really focused on. We want more monitors throughout the San Joaquin Valley so we really know where the pollution is at its worst and where people need the information sooner. We really do believe that the Air District, the Valley Air Board, needs to be doing more to warn people and inform them when dirty air episodes are occurring. But we're a coalition of more than 70 organizations, including DONS, where we're all working throughout the valley and state on the regulatory agencies to do more on the pollution sources. And that happens at three levels of government. In broad terms, you know, the Valley Air Board, the California Air Resources Board, and the federal EPA. There's a lot that needs doing with land use planning at the local level as well.
Right, right. With this report that you all put out, what information should we take from that when it comes to implementing some of the things that Kevin mentioned?
Well, I think, you know, the study showed that with the warming that's expected by 2050, it's about a 3 to 5 degree increase in climate temperatures over the U.S. And we showed that, in fact, if we can reduce that to about a 2 to 4 degree increase, the climate impact on ozone production would be reduced by 70%. So we do have a way forward to help minimize the impacts of this. And so I think, as Kevin mentioned, we really need to look at it from all levels of government, and not just government, but also from the private sector, and engaging stakeholders who need to be part of the solution. One of the biggest challenges is burning fossil fuels, and that's including in our cars and our power plants, and as Kevin mentioned, the agricultural impacts in the valley. So really getting everyone on board and moving forward with some aggressive measures to really take a longer-term look and see how we can transform our energy and our transportation and our agriculture to reduce emissions and achieve healthy air in the valley and elsewhere around the country.
You know, what you're talking about, both you and Kevin, and it is something we've been struggling about because we're trying to balance, you know, air quality and health issues with people's pocketbook, and that's kind of where the problem comes in. Transportation officials or truckers who talk about the extra cost to them. Growers and farmers talk about the extra cost to them. But one thing that we can't dispute is that the air quality is having a huge impact on our health and our children's health. So let's hope that kind of brings everybody together on this issue.
Well, I appreciate your idealism, and as I like to point out, air quality is not a problem. Air pollution is, and I think that there are great opportunities for stakeholders, as Don described the groups, as being able to work together. But at some point, we do run into a basic political problem. And, you know, the science is here. We know that it's a serious problem. The technology is here. We know how to clean it up. It becomes a political process, and that's where vested interests kick and scream the loudest. And I'm not going to apologize for the belief that we do need effective regulation, and it's just the way of the world. And if we want to have a world that is here for our children and grandchildren, we have to get very serious about it soon.
Cleaning it up. Okay, thanks a lot, Kevin Hall, Central Valley Air Quality Coalition, and Don Anair with the Senior Vehicles Analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you both for sharing on this issue. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition.
When children commit violent acts, should they face the same punishment as adults, even if that means life in prison? On this edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Professor Jack Benega says the Supreme Court's recent ruling on mandatory sentences for juveniles is a positive step and one informed by science.
The last week of June is a period that usually excites news junkies. That's the time each year the Supreme Court hands down its rulings for the year. This year, of course, the attention was focused on two very controversial issues before the court: Arizona's immigration law, and President Obama's health care law. Overlooked, but not to be ignored, was another ruling earlier that same week that barred, finally, mandatory life sentences without parole for juveniles convicted of murder. In a 5-4 ruling, Justice Elena Kagan, for the majority, wrote that many state laws mandated life without parole for the most serious juvenile offenders, quote, "even if a judge or jury would have thought that his youth, along with the nature of his crime, made a lesser sentence more appropriate." The New York Times reports that there are currently about 2,000 convicts in our prisons who were sentenced to life without parole as juveniles under mandated sentencing laws. But the picture is even worse for some of them. A 2007 study by the University of San Francisco's Center for Law and Global Justice found that of 44 states that permitted life without parole for juveniles, 13 states had no minimum age for such sentences. California was second in the nation, after Pennsylvania, in the number of people serving mandated life terms for committing crimes before reaching adulthood. 227 Californians fall in this category, including Antonio Nunez, the only child in America known to be condemned to life without parole for a single incident in which no one was injured. Antonio was 14 in 2001 when, in the company of a 27-year-old man he had met at a party, he kidnapped a Santa Ana businessman and shot at police. He was found guilty of attempted murder of a police officer, assault, evading arrest, street terrorism, and committing crimes for the benefit of a street gang. But no one was hurt in this process. The Equal Justice Initiative of Montgomery, Alabama, reports that across the country, 73 children, like Antonio Nunez, have been sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for crimes committed when they were 13 or 14. The United States is the only country in the world known to have condemned children that young to imprisonment till death. The vast majority of these cases involve minority children where judges were forced by state law to impose the sentences without considering the child's age, background, or circumstances of the crime. But now, the mandate for trying children in adult court and imposing life sentences is over. In part, the rationale for the Supreme Court's ruling included research showing that the less well-formed brains of the young make them less morally culpable and more capable of change later. Indeed, MRI research on the developing brains of children and adolescents and young adults shows large differences. Children and adolescents have significantly less myelin in the areas of the brain's frontal lobe than do young adults aged 23 to 30. More myelin is associated with maturation of cognitive functioning and other decision-making skills. Additionally, as parents of teenagers have always known, and as the MRI studies confirm, there are biological reasons for differences in how teens process emotions. They are impulsive and less able to gauge consequences and less able to resist peer pressure. So, the decision reached by the court with respect to sentencing of juveniles who have committed the most egregious crimes means that, from now on, those cases will be adjudicated on the basis of justice informed by science and not by politics. That's reasonable and appropriate and in the best interest of an informed society. The Supreme Court got this right. Good for us. For The Moral Is, this is Jacques Benninga.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Remember the Mammoth Orange, that large fruit-shaped hamburger stand we all passed on Highway 99 as we traveled north? Well, it's getting a new home. Here to tell us more is Blake Bufford. He is with the Fossil Discovery Center in Chowchilla, a very interesting place. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, the Fossil Discovery Center, where it is set up, it's called that because there are a lot of fossils there, right?
That's right. It's situated directly across the road from the Fairmead Landfill, which is the Madera County's dump. And the fossils are excavated there whenever they're digging holes to put the garbage in. And we are we are just west of Highway 99 off of exit Avenue 21 and a half. Between Madera and Chowchilla, and we display a lot of the fossils that have been found there at the Fairmead Landfill.
And it's also an educational opportunity for kids. You display the fossils that are found, but do people have the opportunity to dig as well?
The actual excavation is at the landfill, and that's a restricted area. And but we do have a mock dig at the Fossil Discovery Center, which is a large sand pit, and kids love to go out there and excavate some fossils. We have 22 different replica fossils buried, which they can dig there all day if they want to.
That's great. What will people see when they come to the Fossil Discovery Center?
Well, the first thing you see is a replica of a Columbian mammoth. It's about 14 feet high. It's an exact copy of a mammoth that lived of the type that lived here in the San Joaquin Valley. And we also have several hundred different actual fossils of horses, camels, mammoths, giant sloths, animals that were common here 500,000 years ago up until about 10,000 years ago. And we also have several more replicas of a short-faced bear, a saber-toothed cat, a dire wolf, giant ground sloth. And we have an 8-minute video, which people like to see. We also have a pond situated outside of the Discovery Center, and it is landscaped with completely with plants native to the San Joaquin Valley floor, so people get a glimpse of the valley before it was inhabited by people.
When we talk about history, I mean, this is real history. We're going way back. And I think people would be surprised at the kinds of animals that kind of roam the valley. And that's what you have there. We have a chance to see what kind of animals were here before us.
Right. That's exactly right. The sediment has been dated around the fossils to 500,000 to 700,000 years old. So it's one of the largest middle Pleistocene fossil deposits on the West Coast. And the animals are – a lot of them are extinct. Several of them still exist in the San Joaquin Valley, like coyotes, badgers, ground squirrels. We find those as well. But the amount of bones that come out of the Fairmead landfill is pretty extensive. There's over 30 different species of animals and several of the extinct species, which I already mentioned. But it's a good chance to come there and actually see these actual remains of some of these animals that lived right here in the San Joaquin Valley.
Now, are you open most days where people can come in? Or are there better times than others to come?
We're only closed on Mondays. So we're open Tuesday through Sunday, every weekend, Tuesday through Sunday from 9 to 4. And anytime we're open to the public. We also encourage schools to call up and reserve a field trip. We had over 4,500 school kids come from beginning of March until the first week of June, and that's we had 2,000 last year. This year we had 4,500. They have a really good time. We have a really good program there for kids to come, and it's not just reservation only. It's anybody can come by.
And now one of your latest things that you're doing is you're moving that huge mammoth orange to your site. Is it just to kind of preserve it, or because it's one of those things that are so identifiable with Chow Chow?
Right, exactly. It's a combination of to preserve it and restore it, and it is a part of the for a lot of people's memories right there on Highway 99, and it's called the Mammoth Orange. It was called the Mammoth Orange, coincidentally, before they ever knew there was any mammoths directly across the road, so it fits in. Well with that, so it's a piece of Madera County's early history, and it goes in well with our ancient history as well. And so there was a chance to purchase it, and so that was done. It needs a lot of work to be restored, and eventually it will be restored on the property of the Fossil Discovery Center.
So that's going to be a huge project then for whoever's going to restore that.
Right. I haven't seen it myself, but I understand it's been in storage out in the open for quite a while, and it's in rather bad shape. But we are looking at people to restore it and make it as close as we can to what it originally was and kind of bring that back to life. We can't bring the mammoths back to life, but we can bring back the mammoth orange anyway.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Blake Bufford.
That's right.
With the Fossil Discovery Center in Chowchilla, for coming in and telling us more about the Fossil Discovery Center. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. And you can also email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. And this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.